Anders might call his women servants, but everyone knew what they were. The new Holy Father was no stranger to vice, but now, as he turned and gestured to someone behind the dais, light glinted off the tiny golden hammer pinned to his white robes. And Tyler froze in sudden comprehension. Two of the Holy Father's aides emerged from the hallway behind the dais. Between them was Father Seth. Tyler bit back a groan. Seth and Tyler had received their ordinations in the same year, but Tyler hadn't seen him in a long time. Ever since Seth had been given his own parish in Burnham, out in the southern Reddick, he rarely visited the Arvath. He was a good man and a good priest, so no one ever spoke of it. But all the same, everyone knew about Seth. Even back when they were all novices, Seth had always liked men. Due to Tyler's position as a bookkeeper, he knew that Father Seth kept a companion out in the Reddick, a man far too old to be a clerical aide, although Seth's records listed him as such. When the clerical aide had appeared, Seth's board expenditures had increased significantly. But Tyler had never called attention to this. Priests and cardinals all over the tier kept questionable companions and paid for them with the same contortionist's accounting. But Seth's aide was the wrong gender, and Anders must have found out.
"I will go through this church and root out the backsliders," Anders thundered.
Tyler had never heard Anders preach before, and a distant part of his mind noted that the man had a wonderful speaking voice, deep and booming, reaching the farthest corners of the chapel and echoing back.
"We will purge and cleanse. And we will start with this creature, a priest who has not only violated God's law, but used church funds to subsidize his sickness, supporting his foul lifestyle with his parish's tithe."
Tyler bit his lip, wishing that he had the courage to speak. It was wrong what was happening here, and Wide, beside him, knew it too. He looked at Tyler with helpless, gleaming eyes. Wide and Seth had been good friends, too, all those years ago when they had all been young together.
"God has been wronged. And for every wrong, God demands vengeance."
At this, Wide closed his eyes and bowed his head. Tyler wanted to shout, loud echoes that would bring the vaulted ceiling down over their heads. But he remained silent.
"Seth has forgotten his duty to God. We will remind him."
Anders's voice dropped suddenly. He had ducked behind the table. When he straightened, he was holding a knife.
"Dear God," Wide muttered.
Tyler merely blinked in surprise, wondering if this entire evening was a dream that had suddenly veered into nightmare. The mace's strange visit, the disturbing sight of the guard captain in clerical robes, and now this horrible torch-lit scene. Seth's pale face, alarm dawning in his eyes as he spotted the knife in Anders' hand.
"Strip him."
The two aides laid hold of Seth, who began to struggle. But Seth, like Tyler and Wide, was in his 70s now, and the two younger men overpowered him easily. One pinned Seth's arms behind his back, while the other ripped his robe down the front and tore off the remains. Tyler averted his eyes, but not before he'd seen the evidence of time on Seth's body. A narrow, sunken white chest, arms and legs that had lost all of their taut muscle and now hung with loose skin. Tyler saw much the same thing when he looked down at his own body, a body that had grown pale and slack. He recalled a summer, half a lifetime ago, when their ecclesiastical class had journeyed all the way to the coast, to New Dover, for a look at God's ocean. The water was a miraculous thing, vast and sparkling and endless. And when Wide had thrown off his robes and dashed for the cliff edge, they'd all followed him without thinking, leaping off the rocks and hurtling 30 feet down. The water had been brutally cold, agonizing, but the sun had been shining, a bright golden face above the limitless blue ocean, and in that moment, Tyler was certain that God was looking directly at them, that he was infinitely pleased with what they were becoming.
"Our belief has grown slack," Anders announced.
His eyes glowed with a terrible fervor, and Tyler recalled a rumor he had once heard, that during his years with the region's anti-sodomy squads, Anders had nearly killed a young homosexual, beating him with a plank of lumber until the boy was unconscious and covered in blood. The region's other thugs had to haul Anders off, or he would undoubtedly have murdered the young man right there in the street. Panic slowly dawned as Tyler realized that this was no mere shaming exercise. Seth could be in real danger. Looking heavenward, he caught sight of a hulking, white-robed figure concealed in the shadows of the gallery. The mace, his grim visage inscrutable beneath the cover of his hood, his eyes pinned on Anders 100 feet below.
"Good," Tyler thought almost angrily. "It's right that an outsider should see." "Hold him."
Anders moved in swiftly, and his hands worked with almost surgical precision, so fast that Seth barely had time to make a sound before the deed was done. But Tyler and Wide screamed together, their voices joining a chorus of cries that echoed back and forth between the stone walls of the chapel. Tyler looked down, unable to watch, and found Wide's hand in his, their fingers clasped in the unconscious manner of children. When Anders straightened, his face was splattered with bright crimson. In his hand was a dripping red mass which he flung into the corner of the chapel. Seth had gotten his breath back now, and his first scream was a mad cacophony of sound that seemed to bounce off the highest rafters of the chapel.
"Make sure he survives," Anders ordered the aides. "His work isn't done."
The two acolytes took Seth between them and dragged him forward down the stairs and then up the aisle between the rows of priests. Tyler didn't want to look, but he had to. Red sheeted down Seth's thighs and calves, and a crimson trail followed him up the aisle. Mercifully, Seth appeared to have lost consciousness. His eyes were closed, and his head lolled against his shoulder. The acolytes staggered under his dead weight.
"Look and remember, brothers," Anders thundered from the dais. "God's church has no room for panderers and sodomites. Your sin will be discovered, and God's vengeance is swift."
Tyler felt his dinner, barley soup, climbing up his throat, and swallowed convulsively. Many of the faces around him looked similarly ill, white and frightened. But Tyler spotted plenty of exceptions, smug faces, vindicated faces. Father Ryan, eyes bright with excitement, nodding vigorously at Anders' words. And Tyler, who had not experienced true fury since the early starving days of his childhood in the Almont, suddenly felt rage contract within him. In all of this, where was God? Why did he remain silent?
"Backsliders," Anders intoned solemnly, "repent your works."
Tyler looked up and found the Holy Father's gaze locked on him.
"Ty?" Wide asked in an undertone, his voice plaintive. "Ty, what do we do?"
"We wait,"
Tyler replied firmly, his eyes pinned on the river of scarlet at his feet.
"We wait for God to show us the way."
And yet even this statement sounded hollow to Tyler's ears. He looked toward the dome of the chapel, toward heaven, waiting for some sign. But none came. And a moment later, he saw that the gallery was empty. The mace had disappeared.
When Kelsey had finished with Arliss, she dismissed Anderli and returned to her own chamber alone. She was tired of people today. Everyone seemed to have constant demands, even Arliss, who knew better than anyone how strapped the crown was for men and money. Arliss wanted to provide armed protection for a small portion of farmers to stay out in the Almont until the 11th hour. Kelsey could see the argument. With the Almont emptied, the entire autumn crop harvest would be lost. But she had no idea where to get the manpower. Bermond would howl if she asked for even a fraction of his soldiers. And though Kelsey disliked the old general, she knew that he was indeed stretched extremely thin. Perhaps a fourth of the Tyr army was deployed in and around the Argive Pass, making sure that the Mort didn't open it up as a potential supply line. The rest of Bermond's men were scattered across the eastern Almont, busily moving refugees inward toward New London. Hall's battalion was entrenched on the border. There were simply no more men to spare. Kelsey left Penn behind in the antechamber without a word, drawing the curtains closed behind her. Anderli had made her a mug of tea, but Kelsey ignored it. Tea would only keep her awake. She brushed her hair and rearranged her desk, feeling restless and exhausted, but not at all sleepy. What she really wanted to do was to return to her library, to the continuing puzzle of Lily Mayhew. Who was she? Kelsey had gone through more than 10 of Carlin's history books now, looking for any reference to either Lily or Greg Mayhew. But there was nothing, not even the books published closest to the crossing. Whoever the Mayhews were, they seemed to have faded into obscurity. But still, the riddle of Lily seemed infinitely solvable compared to the problem on the eastern border. Kelsey was certain that if she could only find the right book, the answer would present itself, and Lily would become clear. But no solutions were forthcoming for the problem of the Mort. She couldn't go back to the library now. Penn needed his sleep. Kelsey had gone to bed early for the last 3 nights, but Penn still looked very ragged. She had begun to wonder whether he ever slept, or whether he simply sat there on his pallet, sword across his knees, as the night turned into morning. There was no reason for him to be so vigilant. Mace now had well over 30 Queen's Guards under his command, and the keep itself was more secure than ever. But still, the image of Penn, sitting there, motionless, staring into the darkness, was strangely persuasive. Kelsey didn't know how to make him sleep when she barely slept herself. After a moment's thought, she tiptoed toward the mirror. She had deliberately avoided looking for the past week, and although she ascribed this to Carlin's strictures about vanity, the real reason was much simpler. She was terrified. Except for a few moments of rogue longing, Kelsey had more or less resigned herself to the fact that she would spend her life with a round, friendly farm girl's face, good-natured but unremarkable. She had often wished that she were beautiful, but it simply wasn't in the cards, and she had come to terms with her appearance as best she could. Now she felt a deep ripple of fear as she studied her face in the mirror, remembering something Carlin had once said. Corruption begins with a single moment of weakness. Kelsey couldn't remember what they'd been talking about, but she seemed to remember Carlin looking at Barty, judgment in her gaze. Now, staring at herself in the mirror, Kelsey knew that Carlin was right. Corruption didn't happen all at once. It was a gradual, insidious process. Kelsey neither felt nor saw anything occurring, but change had crept up on her back. Her nose was transforming. That was the first thing. It had always sat in the middle of her face like a squashed mushroom, too big for its surroundings. But now, to Kelsey's searching eyes, her nose had lengthened, become tapered, so that it emerged quite naturally and gracefully from the ridge between her eyes. The rounded, slightly piggish upturn had softened at the tip. Her eyes were still a bright cat's green, the shape of almonds,
but the pockets of flesh around them had been steadily eroding, and now the eyes themselves seemed larger, dominating Kelsey's face in a way they never had before. Perhaps the most noticeable change was Kelsey's mouth, which had always been full-lipped and flat, too wide for her face. Now it too had shrunk, the top lip thinning slightly, so that the bottom looked fuller, a deep, healthy pink. Her cheeks had dropped weight as well, so that her face was oval rather than round. Everything seemed to fit better than it had before. She wasn't beautiful, Kelsey thought, not by any stretch. But she was no longer plain either. She looked like a woman someone might actually remember. At what cost? Kelsey shrank from the question. She was no longer afraid that she might be sick, for she had plenty of energy, and the image before her was the very picture of health. But beneath the initial pleasure she felt, looking at this new woman, there was a sense of great falsity. Here was beauty blooming from nowhere. Beauty that reflected no change inside. "I'm still me," Kelsey whispered. That was the important thing, wasn't it? She was still fundamentally herself, and yet, several times lately, she had caught Mace giving her hard looks, as though trying to analyze her face. The rest of the guard, well, who knew what they talked about once they retreated to their quarters at night? If things continued in this vein, they might well think her a sorceress, just like the Red Queen. They were still worried about the trance she'd had that night in the library. Whenever Kelsey stumbled these days, there seemed to be several guards at her arm to hold her up. She closed her eyes and saw again the pretty pre-crossing woman with the sad eyes, the deep lines around her mouth, the bruises. "Who are you, Lily?" No one knew. Lily had vanished into the past with the rest of humanity. But Kelsey couldn't be satisfied with that. Her sapphires operated outside of her control, their actions inconsistent and maddening. But they had never shown her anything she didn't need to see. "What makes you think it's the sapphires? They've been dead for weeks." Kelsey blinked at that. True, the sapphires had done almost nothing since the Argive. But Kelsey was not like Andalai. She had no magic of her own. All of her power, everything extraordinary that she had ever done, was bedrocked on these two pieces of blue stone, both of which could fit comfortably in her pocket. Kelsey risked another look in the mirror, and almost flinched at the calmly attractive woman she saw there. "How can the jewels be dead? They're transforming your face." "God," Kelsey whispered, shuddering. She whirled away from the mirror, almost as if preparing to flee, and stopped short. A man stood in front of the fireplace, a tall black silhouette against the flames. Kelsey opened her mouth to shout for Penn, then held back, drawing a long, shaky breath. The fetch, of course. It was well known that no doors kept him out. She tiptoed a few steps closer. And then, as the firelight crossed his profile, she started. The man before her was not the fetch. But all the same, she found herself physically unable to scream or to make any sound at all. He was beautiful. There was no other word. He reminded her of the drawings of Eros in Carlin's books of mythology. He was tall and thin, not dissimilar to the fetch in build. But that was where the similarity ended. This man had a sensualist's face, slightly hollowed cheekbones tapering to a full-lipped mouth. His eyes were deep-set, but somehow wide, their colour indeterminate. By a trick of the firelight, the eyes seemed to gleam a deep red for a moment before fading. "Tyr Eir?" Kelsey shook her head to clear it. He hadn't spoken out loud, she was sure. But still, his voice echoed inside her head, a low hum with a clear tear accent. Her pulse sped up and her breath shortened as though both reactions had been set to a metronome. Her palms, dry as a bone moments before, had begun to sweat. She opened her mouth to speak, and he put a finger to his lips.
"We meet in the quiet, Tyr Eir."
Kelsey blinked. Behind the curtain drawn over the doorway, she could still hear Penn moving around, getting ready for bed. He hadn't heard a thing.
"Nothing to say."
She peeked down at her sapphires, but they lay dark and quiescent against the black silk of her dress, silk that now hung loosely on Kelsey's frame. Her mind tilted dizzily, and she felt intoxicated, as though she should slap herself awake. She met the man's eyes, and a thought arrowed out of her as cleanly as breathing. "Who are you?"
"A friend."
Kelsey thought not. Andalai's warnings recurred to her, but she didn't need Andalai to know that this man didn't come in friendship. His gaze seemed to pin her where she stood, and she had the sense that all of his attention was focused on her, that nothing was so important to him as Kelsey Glynn at this moment. Handsome as sin, Andalai had warned, but she had failed to do him justice. Kelsey had never had any man seem utterly absorbed in her before, and it was a seductive feeling.
"What do you want?" she asked him.
"Only to help you, Tyr Eir. Do you wish to know of the Mort Queen, of the movements of her army, where she is weak? I can tell you all of these things."
"Free of charge, I suppose?"
"Wise child. Everything has a price."
"What's the price?"
He pointed to her hand, which had crept up almost unconsciously to clutch her two sapphires.
"You hold jewels of enormous power, Tyr Eir. You could do me a great service."
"Enormous power?"
After the Argive, Kelsey supposed that was true. But what good was all the power in the world if she couldn't control it, couldn't summon it on command? Inconsistent power would not mitigate the Mort army's massive advantage in size and weaponry.
"What power?"
"I have seen one jewel alter time and create miracles. But the other has the power of flesh. And you have a strong will, Tyr Eir. You will be able to flay skin and crush bones."
Kelsey considered this idea for a moment, darkly fascinated. She closed her eyes and saw it suddenly, the Almont stretched between horizons and the Mort army cowering, fleeing before her.
Was it possible?
The man in front of her smiled as though he had read her mind, and gestured toward the fireplace.
"Look and see."
Kelsey found a wide mirage in front of the flames, a broad vista of salt flats and black water that could only be western Mortmain, Lake Kachmar. It must be where the Mort army lay massed at the base of the border hills. But now the hillside was in chaos, treetops aflame and men in black uniforms fighting wildly. A pall of smoke covered the trees.
"Here are your soldiers, Tyr Eir. They will fall."
The Tyr were being pressed back now, overwhelmed by superior numbers and forced back up the hillside. Hall's battalion, Kelsey realized, and they were going to die. Pain sliced through her, and she reached out toward the mirage, wanting to grasp them, to carry them away. The man snapped his fingers, and the mirage winked out, leaving only firelight. She thought of calling for Penn, but the stranger's gaze seemed to hold her frozen.
"The Mort Queen has vulnerabilities. They are exploitable. And the service I ask in return is very small."
Thinking of Andalai's warning, Kelsey shook her head.
"I want no part of you."
"Ah, but that's not true, Tyr Eir. I have watched you for some time. You long to be an adult, but those around you often treat you like a child." Is it not so?
Kelsey didn't reply. The man stepped forward, giving her every chance to back away, and placed a hand around her waist. His hand was warm, and Kelsey immediately felt the skin beneath turn hot and feverish. Pressure echoed deep in the pit of her stomach.
I will never treat you as a child, Tyr Eir. I have never cared whether you were pretty or plain. I have known myriad women, but I will treat you as unique.
Kelsey believed him. It was the voice, its hollow tone so smoothly confident that they seemed to weave certainty out of thin air. She met his eyes and found them understanding, full of some sort of dark knowledge of Kelsey that he had no business having. For a moment she was tempted. So strong was the pull of being an adult with a life of her own, of making terrible mistakes the way everyone else was allowed to. And this man would be a good choice, for he had been the ruination of many women, she had no doubt.
But weaker women than me, a voice spoke up quietly inside her. I'm not one to be taken in.
Carefully, she removed his hand from her waist. His skin was oddly dry, but even this was exciting in its own way. She couldn't help wondering what such dry hands would feel like between her legs, whether they would elicit the same sensations as her own. She backed away from him, trying to regain some control of herself, some equilibrium.
What do you want? She demanded. Be explicit.
Freedom.
Who imprisons you?
Mine is not a dungeon of walls, Tyr Eir.
Speak more plainly, or get out.
Admiration sparked in the man's eyes. He moved closer, but stopped when Kelsey held up a hand.
I am imprisoned, Tyr Eir. And you have the power to set me free.
In exchange for what?
I offer you a chance to defeat the Mort Queen and achieve greatness. You will sit on your throne long after all you know has crumbled into dust.
Did you promise her the same thing?
This time it was his turn to blink. A stab in the dark, but a good one. The Red Queen's extraordinary age had never been explained, and it stood to reason that a man... Is he a man? Kelsey wondered for the first time. Who would try this with one queen would certainly try it with another.
I have no wish to emulate the Red Queen.
You will say so, he replied, until the moment when her legions smash your army into rubble.
The words were so close to what Kelsey had seen in her mind that she shivered, and saw that this gave him pleasure somehow.
You'll beg for the opportunity to be cruel.
I will not, she replied. And if you seek cruelty in me, you won't find it.
Cruelty is in everyone, Tyr Eir. It takes only the right application of pressure to coax it out.
Leave now, or I will call my guard.
I have no fear of your guard. I could wring his neck with little effort.
The words froze Kelsey, but she merely repeated,
Leave. I am not interested.
He smiled.
But you are, Tyr Eir, and I will be waiting when you call.
The man's form dissolved suddenly, coalescing into a black mass that seemed to hover in the air. Kelsey stumbled backward, her heart thudding. The mass streamed like shadow into the fireplace, falling on the flames like a curtain, dimming them, and then putting them out entirely, leaving the room cold and dark. In the sudden blackness, Kelsey lost her balance and landed against her bedside table, knocking it over.
Shit, she muttered, feeling her way around on the floor.
Lady? Penn asked from the doorway, and she gasped. For a moment she'd forgotten the existence of anyone but her visitor, and that seemed the most dangerous development of all.
Are you all right?
I'm fine, Pen. Just stupid.
What happened to your fire?
A draught. Even in the dark, she could hear Penn's silent skepticism. His soft cat-like tread moved across the chamber toward the fireplace. Don't bother. She fumbled on the floor among the items that had fallen off the bedside table. I'll just light a candle.
Have you been practicing sorcery, lady?
Kelsey paused in the act of striking a match. Why do you ask?
We're not blind. We see what's happening to you. Mesa's forbidden us to speak of it.
Then perhaps you'd better not. Kelsey lit the candle and found Penn a few feet away, concern in his face.
I'm not practicing sorcery. You've become quite pretty.
Kelsey scowled.
Pleasure welled up in her that Penn thought her pretty, but the pleasure was quickly subsumed under anger. She had not been pretty enough before. She felt as though she couldn't win.
Her heart rate was still elevated, and her body felt frazzled. Penn's handsome face was open, filled with the same honest concern as ever, but then Penn had always been good to her. All the way back to the Reddick Forest, when most of the guard would probably have been just as happy to leave her behind. As Penn helped her up, Kelsey couldn't help noticing other things. Penn was muscular. He had that whipcord body, well developed on top and lithe on the bottom, that Venner extolled as an absolute necessity for a top-notch swordsman. Penn was quick and strong and intelligent. And perhaps, even more important, he was trustworthy, exceptionally so. Even in a cadre of guards chosen for their ability to keep their mouths shut. Anything that happened in this room would stay here. Penn?
Lady?
You think I'm pretty? He blinked in surprise.
I always found you so, lady. But it's true that your face has changed.
You always found me pretty? Penn shrugged.
It doesn't matter, lady. Some women are defined by their appearance, but you have never been one of them.
Kelsey didn't know how to take that. Penn had begun to look uncomfortable now, and she wondered if he was being deliberately obtuse.
But do you... You seem tired, lady. I should let you sleep.
Penn turned away and headed for the door.
Penn.
He turned back, though he seemed unwilling to meet her eyes.
You could sleep in here, with me.
Penn's eyes snapped to hers, and his face suddenly seemed to drain of all colour, as though Kelsey had slapped him. He shoved his hands into his pockets and turned away.
Lady, I'm a Queen's Guard. I can't.
This was an outright lie, one that made blood darken Kelsey's cheeks. Her mother's entire guard had tumbled in and out of bed with the Queen. If Arliss was to be believed, even Mace himself had done so.
Pretty indeed, Kelsey thought.
So pretty that even with no cost attached he wants no part of me. Blood roared in her ears and she felt a terrible realization creeping up on her. The knowledge of how badly she had just humiliated herself. It took only a moment for humiliation to ignite into anger.
You're full of shit, Penn. You could... You just don't want to. Lady, I'm off to bed.
In the morning. Penn swallowed again convulsively, and Kelsey felt a moment of grim satisfaction.
At least he was embarrassed as well. In the morning, we'll forget about all of this. Sleep well.
Kelsey smiled at him, but the smile felt bitter and frozen. She had made the worst possible choice for this little experiment. The one guard she would have to see constantly, day in and day out. Penn went back into his antechamber and prepared to pull the curtain. Penn? He paused.
Despite your active social life, I'll need you at your best in the coming weeks. Whoever she is, tell her to let you get more sleep.
Penn's face froze. He jerked the curtain shut, and she heard the distinctive thump of his body falling onto the mattress. Then silence. a deep wounded part of her mind hoped that he would lie awake for hours. But within a few minutes, he began to snore. Kelsey had never felt further from sleep. She stared at the lit candle on her bedside table, willing herself to blow it out, but she couldn't seem to work up the energy. The entire odd evening seemed to beg for analysis, but she didn't even have the energy for that. Her body was still a mess of involuntary reactions. She rolled over and punched the pillow, hating the frenzy inside her. She reached down to touch herself, then realized it would be no good right now. She was too angry, too ashamed. What she really wanted was to hurt someone, to flay skin and crush bones. The handsome man's words echoed inside her head. He had offered immortality, but that was only a word. Immortality for Kelsey would not solve the problems of the Tearling. He was imprisoned, the man had said, a prison without walls. He wanted Kelsey to set him free. Kelsey took her sapphires in her palm and stared at them for a thoughtful moment. Perhaps the man didn't know that they barely worked any more, that Kelsey didn't truly command them. Flay skin and crush bones? But whose skin? Whose bones? She hated Penn in this moment, but she knew that he had not done anything wrong. Penn did not deserve her hatred. There was no one to harm but herself. Kelsey raised her left arm, staring at it. She had already endured terrible pain, the knife in her shoulder, the wound from the hawk. But what her mind dug up instead was Lily Mayhew. Lily's life was relatively comfortable for her times, but even in that brief moment of memory, Kelsey had sensed something terrible in Lily's future, an oncoming trial by fire. She studied the smooth white skin of her forearm, trying to focus, imagining the layers of flesh beneath. Just a scratch. It would barely hurt. But Kelsey sensed her subconscious mind revolting at the idea, all the same. Flay skin and crush bones. Just the skin, Kelsey whispered, staring at her arm, focusing all of her will on a tiny inch of flesh. She'd borne worse. Surely she could handle this. Just a scratch. A shallow line of red appeared on her forearm. Kelsey bore down, watching the line deepen, her breath hissing through her teeth as the skin parted with a sting, allowing a thin line of blood to well up and hold. At the sight of the blood, Kelsey smiled wide. She felt connected to her body, to each nerve. Pain was not pleasant, certainly, but it was good to feel something more than helplessness. She blotted her arm on the sheet and turned on her side, barely feeling the sting of the wound, not hearing the rumble of Penn snoring in the next room at all. She was too busy staring at the fireplace, thinking of Mort Mayne.
Lady.
Kelsey looked up and found Mace standing in the doorway. Andalai gave her hair a hard tug, and Kelsey winced.
The Holy Father is here.
Andalai set down the brush. It will do, lady. I could have done a better job with more time.
His Holiness won't appreciate it anyway,
Kelsey muttered, her voice petulant. She had been dreading this dinner all week, but her discomfort in this moment had nothing to do with the Holy Father. What she saw in the mirror was beyond belief. Mace had said nothing about it, and neither had Penn. But Andalai, who did her hair every day, could hardly fail to notice. Kelsey's hair had grown at least 8 inches in the past week, and it was now below her shoulders. She was no longer worried about being ill, but even illness would have been something definite, something known. Andalai must have seen some of Kelsey's upset, for she put a firm hand on Kelsey's shoulder and murmured, "It will be all right."
"I've had an interesting report from Mort Mayne, lady," Mace continued.
"The army?"
"No, the people." Mort discontent has been spreading ever since you stopped the shipment. And now there's apparently a protest movement afoot. Right now it's concentrated primarily in Cité Marche and the northern market villages, but cells are already spreading south toward Dimain.
Led by who?
A man no one has ever seen, named Leveux. Apparently he's very anxious to conceal his face.
The Fetch?
Possible, lady. We've heard nothing from the Fetch since he left that little bit of decor on the keep lawn. Arliss has received many tax payments from noble estates in the past month, but we've had no complaints of robbery or harassment. Something keeps him busy.
Kelsey took a deep breath that she hoped was unobtrusive.
Well, if it keeps him from stealing my taxes, so much the better.
Also, the Red Queen has given an odd set of orders. No one throughout the entire palais is allowed to light a fire in any fireplace.
Kelsey's mind went immediately to the handsome man who had appeared in her chamber. Given the loyalty of her guard, and despite the mistakes of the past, Kelsey did consider that a given. There was certainly no way for a stranger to simply waltz into the Queen's wing. The man had departed via the fire. It seemed a reasonable assumption that he had come from the fire as well. The handsome man had mentioned the Red Queen, hadn't he? Kelsey struggled to remember his exact words. If the Red Queen was afraid of this creature, he must be dangerous indeed.
You already knew he was dangerous, her mind mocked gently. 10 minutes of conversation and he nearly had your dress off.
Does this mean anything to you, lady?
Mace asked. Kelsey had not been as careful as she should have been. Mace had always had a gift for reading her face, even in the mirror.
No. As you say, it's odd.
Mace watched her for another moment.
When Kelsey said nothing, he moved on, but she knew that she hadn't deceived him. Be careful with the Holy Father, lady. He's nothing but trouble.
You can't be concerned about violence.
Mace opened his mouth and then closed it.
Not tonight.
He was going to say something else. Kelsey thanked Andalai and headed for the door, Mace and Penn trailing behind her. For the past 2 days she had done her best to make no eye contact with Penn, and he seemed just as happy to have it so. But this state of affairs could not hold for long. Kelsey wished she could think of a way to punish Penn, to make him feel as much regret as she did. And then she realized that her appearance wasn't the only thing that had changed. She was different now. The handsome man's words about cruelty recurred.
It takes only the right application of pressure to coax it out.
I'm not cruel, Kelsey insisted, but she didn't know whom she was trying to convince.
God's church holds a vast amount of sway in this kingdom, lady, like it or not,
Mace continued, as they headed down the hallway.
What's your temper tonight?
Telling me to watch my temper is the first and best way to wake it up, Lazarus.
Well, I've put Father Tyler between you. At least, have a care for him.
They entered the audience chamber to find Father Tyler waiting with his usual timid smile. But tonight, the smile betrayed anxiety as well, an anxiety that Kelsey read easily. Father Tyler's two worlds were colliding, and Kelsey, who had long suspected that she saw a different man than the one who lived in the Arvath, wondered if he dreaded the evening as much as she did. She needed the resources of the Arvath now, but she didn't like the idea of going to the Holy Father with hat in hand.
I'm not, she reminded herself. We're here to trade.
Hello, Father.
Good evening, Majesty. May I introduce His Holiness?
Kelsey turned her attention to the new Holy Father. She had pictured an old man, shrunken and shriveled. But this man was no older than Mace. He didn't radiate Mace's vitality. Rather, Kelsey got no impression from him at all. His features were thick and heavy, the eyes dark, opaque pits, and upon seeing her, his face remained immobile. Kelsey had never received such an impression of blank nothingness from anyone. After a few seconds, she realized that God's mouthpiece was not going to bow. Rather, he expected her to bow to him.
Your Holiness?
Seeing that Kelsey would not bow either, the Holy Father smiled, a functional lifting of the corners of his mouth that did nothing to change the lifelessness of his face.
Queen Kelsey.
Thank you for coming.
She gestured toward the enormous dining table which had been laid out for 10 people.
Have a seat.
Two acolytes, one tall and one short, followed at the Holy Father's elbow. The tall one had the pointed face of a weasel, and he seemed vaguely familiar to Kelsey. He was clearly the favored assistant. It was he who drew the chair out, then pushed it back in after the Holy Father had seated himself. Both acolytes stationed themselves behind the Holy Father's chair. They would not be eating, were clearly meant to fade into the landscape. But Kelsey's attention returned to the tall acolyte several times over the course of dinner. She had seen him before. But where?
No guards, she whispered to Penn as they sat down.
The Holy Father always travels with a complement of 4 armed guards, lady, he whispered back, but the captain insisted they remain outside.
Father Tyler was seated on Penn's other side, only one seat from Kelsey. The Holy Father blinked in surprise when he took his place.
Do you always eat with so many of your guard, Majesty?
Usually.
Are security concerns so great?
Not at all. I prefer to eat with my guard.
Perhaps when you begin a family, that will change.
Kelsey narrowed her eyes as Mila began to ladle soup into her bowl.
My guard are my family.
But surely, Majesty, one of your first duties is the production of an heir.
I have more pressing concerns right now, Your Holiness.
And I have many worried parishioners, Majesty. They would have both heir and spare as soon as possible. Uncertainty is bad for a morale.
You would have me get pregnant, as my mother did then, under the table?
Certainly not, Majesty. We don't preach wanton sexuality, though it's undeniable that your mother was guilty of such. We would have you married and settled.
Penn nudged her with his foot, and Kelsey realized that the entire table was waiting for her to begin eating. She shook her head.
Forgive me. Please start.
Miller's tomato soup was usually quite good, but tonight Kelsey could barely taste it. The remark about her mother had been too crude, too overt. The Holy Father was trying to goad her, but to what end? His two acolytes stood behind him, motionless, but their eyes were constantly moving, clocking the room. The entire evening already felt wrong. Father Tyler was taking careful spoonfuls of soup, but Kelsey saw that he was eating nothing, that each spoonful went right back into the bowl. Father Tyler never ate much. He was an ascetic. But now his eyes were sunken in dark pockets of flesh, as though bruised. And Kelsey wondered, again, what had happened to him. The Holy Father hadn't even picked up his spoon. He merely stared at his soup bowl, his eyes empty as the others ate. This was so rude, particularly since Mila hovered anxiously 10 feet from the table, that Kelsey was finally forced to ask, "Is there something else we can bring you, Your Holiness?"
"Not at all, Majesty. I simply don't like tomato."
Kelsey shrugged. A man who didn't like tomato was to be more pitied than despised. She ate mechanically for a few minutes, breathing slowly in and out between spoonfuls. But she was unable to ignore the Holy Father, who seemed to be lurking in wait across the table. Since he clearly wished to make her angry, Kelsey tried to smooth her temper, a mental exercise akin to laying a velvet carpet across a field of spikes. She didn't want to ask this old liar for help, at least not outright, not as a supplicant. But she couldn't wait all night for an opening to come up in the conversation. Movement over Elston's shoulder distracted her. Her guard had just admitted the magician, a sandy-haired man of medium build. The last time Kelsey had seen him, she had been a frightened girl riding through the city, but she had not forgotten. And at her request, Mace had tracked the magician down. His name was Bradshaw, and until now he had been strictly a street performer. An engagement at the keep would be quite an opportunity for him. Kelsey's attention was drawn to his fingers, which were long and clever, even in the quotidian acts of removing hat and cloak. Mace didn't rate the magician as a particular threat to Kelsey's person, but as always, he remained wary of all things magical, and had warned Kelsey that security might tighten in odd ways over the course of the evening. Kelsey's instincts had been right. When she finally finished her soup and set down her spoon, the Holy Father pounced.
"Majesty, at the request of my congregation, I must bring up several unpleasant matters."
"Your congregation? You still give sermons?"
"All of humanity is my congregation."
"Even those who want no part of it?"
"Those who want no part of God's kingdom are the most in need, Majesty."
"What's the first unpleasant matter?"
"The destruction of the Graham Castle some months ago."
"I understand it was gutted by an accidental fire."
"Many of my congregation believe that fire to be no accident, Majesty. Indeed, the prevailing belief is that the fire was set by one of your own guards."
"Prevailing belief is very convenient. Have you any proof?"
"I do."
Kelsey drew a sharp breath. Mace, on her right, had frozen. But the Holy Father only continued to stare blandly at Kelsey. He seemed to have no fear of Mace at all. Kelsey considered asking the Holy Father to produce his proof, but discarded the idea. If he really did have something linking Mace to the fire, there was nowhere else to go. She shifted ground. "An assassination attempt on the Queen is treachery. I believe the common law states that treachery renders the traitor's lands forfeit."
"So it does."
"Lord Graham put a knife to my throat, Your Holiness. Even in the unlikely event that one of my guard was involved with that fire, his property was mine to burn."
"But not the people inside, Majesty."
"If they were on my property, they were trespassing."
"But your ownership of that property depends entirely on your own accusations of treachery."
"My accusations?" Kelsey repeated. "What else would you call Lord Graham's actions?"
"I don't know, Majesty. As you say, there's so little proof." "What do we know? Only that you had a young, attractive lord in your chamber in the early evening, and you killed him."
Kelsey's mouth dropped open.
"Perhaps you had your eye on his lands all along."
Penn pushed back from the table, but Kelsey grabbed his arm and whispered,
"No, lady,
do nothing." Meeting Penn's gaze was a mistake. In that moment, Kelsey seemed to live her humiliation all over again. This was her oldest friend, the guard who had been kind to her long before any of the others. But all Kelsey could see was the man who had turned her down. How could they ever get back to where they had been before? She turned back to the Holy Father and found him watching her and Penn with an interested gaze. "So this is the story your priests tell from the pulpit, Your Holiness? Young Lord Graham was a victim of my wanton sexuality?" Elston and Dyer began sniggering.
"Majesty, you misunderstand me. I am only a mouthpiece for my congregation's concerns."
"I thought you were the mouthpiece for God." The shorter acolyte gasped.
"Such a statement would be blasphemous, Majesty,"
the Holy Father replied, his tone gently reproving.
"No man can speak for God."
"I see." She didn't see, but at least she had gotten him off the subject of Mace and the fire. Mila took the pause in conversation as an opportunity to bring the main course, roast chicken with potatoes.
Kelsey snuck a glance at Penn and found him staring with cold fury at the Holy Father. All of her guard were angry now, even Mace, whose mouth had tightened. Kelsey tapped her nails on the table, and they returned their attention to the food, though some of them appeared to have difficulty swallowing.
"Have you heard the reports from the Fair Witch, Majesty?"
the Holy Father asked. "I have. Children disappearing, and some invisible murderer that stalks in the night."
"How do you plan to address the matter?"
"Difficult to say, until I get some hard evidence of what's going on."
"While you wait, Majesty, the problem grows worse. Cardinal Penny tells me that several families have disappeared in the foothills. The Cardinal himself has seen dark shadows in the night around his castle. It's the devil's work, for certain."
"And how would you suggest that I fight the devil?"
"Prayer, Majesty. Devotion. Have you never considered that this might be God's vengeance on the Tierling?"
"For what?"
"For laxity of faith. For backsliding."
Father Tyler dropped his fork. It hit the ground with a clatter, and he crawled under the table to retrieve it. "Prayer will not save us from a serial killer, Your Holiness."
"Then what will?"
"Action. Judicious action, taken after all the consequences are weighed."
"Your faith is weak, Majesty."
Kelsey put down her fork. "You will not goad me."
"I had not thought to goad, only to offer spiritual advice. Many of your actions subvert God's will."
Kelsey saw where this was going now, and she leaned her chin on both hands. "Do tell, Your Holiness." The Holy Father raised his eyebrows.
"You wish me to list your transgressions?"
"Why not?"
"Fine, Majesty. I will. 3 heretics and 2 homosexuals were in crown custody at the start of your reign, and you have freed them all. Worse, you tolerate open homosexuality in your own guard."
What was this? Kelsey fought down the urge to look at Mace or at any other member of her guard. She had never heard a whisper of any such thing.
"Your own failure to marry sets a terrible example for young women everywhere. I have heard speculations that you may have homosexual sympathies yourself."
"Indeed, Your Holiness. The sexual freedom of consenting adults is the greatest threat this kingdom has ever faced," Kelsey replied acidly. "God knows how we've lasted so long." The Holy Father was not derailed.
"And most recently, Majesty, I have been informed that you mean to tax the Arvath, like any secular body, on its landholdings. But surely this must be a mistake."
"Ah, so we finally come to it. No mistake, Your Holiness. God's Church is a landholder like any other. Beginning in February, I will expect monthly payments on all of your property."
"The Church has always been exempt from taxation, Majesty. All the way back to David Raleigh. The exemption encourages good works and selflessness on the part of our brothers."
"You reap profit from your land, Your Holiness, and despite your mandate, you are not a charitable institution. I don't see the vast bulk of your income flowing back to the public."
"We distribute bread to the poor, Majesty."
"Well done. Saint Simone herself could hardly do more." Kelsey leaned forward, trying to soften the edge in her voice. "However, since you bring up the point, I have an offer for you."
"What is that?"
"If my estimates are correct, by the end of July, most of the Tierling will be housed at the Cadell camp outside the walls. When the Mort come, all of the displaced will need to be brought into the city."
"That will make New London terribly crowded, Majesty."
"Indeed. And since you claim to be a charitable institution, I thought you could show some of that Christian spirit by providing food and housing as well."
"Housing?"
"I will be opening the keep to refugees, but you have the second largest building in New London, Your Holiness. 9 floors,
and I'm told that only two of them are actually used for housing.
How do you know that?
The Holy Father asked angrily, and Kelsey was dismayed to